Okay, so thanks to the organizers. This is really fun being here, and I'm learning a lot. Thanks to my collaborators, Caleb especially, who I'll show a bunch of his data. What I want to talk about is the structure of turbulent wall flow, turbulent boundary layer in particular, at high Reynolds number, and focusing on the inertial sublayer in physical space, where we're interested in a logarithmic mean velocity profile. Now, I'll be talking a lot about the logarithmic mean velocity profile, but hopefully you'll gain some appreciation that the mean flow theory I have has some relationship to other things as well, and is maybe perhaps a little more satisfying than existing mean flow theories. So some nomenclature, we'll use delta for the half channel height. I'll do the channel first because it's simpler, and then I'll extend it to the boundary layer. U tau friction velocity plus variables are inner normalized. Eta is our outside variable or outer variable. Delta plus will be the Reynolds number, but it may show up as an RE tau on some of the slides. Okay, so here's the logarithmic mean velocity profile, and this is at pretty high Reynolds number, so it goes up to about 20,000. These were taken at the UNH flow physics facility, and what we'll be talking about is the region here where we have logarithmic dependence, and talk a little bit about the value of kappa, the von Karman constant. That slope is 1 over the von Karman constant, and for that we use 0.387, but if I would have used a 0.38 or 0.39, you wouldn't have seen the difference on this figure. What's different from the boundary layer case is that, at least in terms of this theory, or it was an open question, that the theory for why we get logarithmic dependence wasn't as well developed, and that's what I want to develop here, or show here. And so one of the issues that's associated with this is the value of the von Karman constant as the Reynolds number becomes very large. And recent evidence, this is from the paper by Marusik et al. In 2013, they showed that for both pipe flow and for boundary layers, you get the same value for the von Karman constant. So what did they do here? They took the mean profile and they subtracted off the logarithmic part, and so this should plateau at the selected value of kappa, and the kappa value they got to make these plateau was 0.39 for both those cases, even though they have different boundary conditions. Okay, and the other thing they showed was, and this is in accord with the theory I'll be describing, is that the logarithmic region doesn't start at order nu over u tau, but actually starts at order square root Reynolds number in y plus units away from the wall. And so these are differences, and what I want to show is first a channel flow result that gets you to a logarithmic profile by integrating the mean momentum equation. And then we'll do the same thing with the boundary layer, but it's more complicated because there's a mean advection term. So let's just, kappa, by the way, is not a time-dependent quantity, or it's supposed to be, okay? So von Karman, a pretty smart guy, apparently, he got a value of about 0.38, and then we went many years, and it was like 0.4, and then Coles did this big review, and he got a value about 0.41, and all through my graduate career, 0.41 was, you know, orthodoxy. And then if you go to these are atmospherics folks, and they get bigger range, but, you know, there's one study here, where is it, down here, where they were out on the, so there's something about fluid mechanicians liking to go to hostile environments. So they took a bunch of measurements up on the ice sheet in the Arctic, soon to become an ocean sheet, I guess. So these are timely experiments, and they got 0.387. And then if you look at the later measurements and estimates, they're getting closer to 0.3 to 0.9, or 0.38 to 0.39. The blue ones are values derived independent of the mean profile, or in a different manner from the mean profile, from the present theory, and I'll refer to those a little later on. Okay, so just a really, really quick review, and I hope well, I don't think there's a lot of mean flow theory people in this audience, so I'm probably not going to insult anybody, but there's really two ways you can kind of get at a log law. Prandtl came up with perhaps the most simple and appealing is that it just says, well, we've got a velocity gradient, we're going to say it's proportional to u tau over y in some interior domain, and if we want to make that an equal sign, we put in a constant, and then you integrate that and you get a logarithmic profile. Okay, so this is distance from the wall scaling, which is used tremendously within turbulence wall theory and is the basis for example, Townsend's wall attached eddy model and hypothesis. And then the other method, it borrows from the theory of matched asymptotic expansions, except you, because of the unclosed nature of the equations, you can only take that so far, and basically it comes down to postulating an inner function, an outer function, and you say that they overlap in some interior domain through these weighted gradients, and that they are equal to each other, and that the constant of equality is kappa, and you solve for that, and you get a log law. This is unsatisfying for a number of reasons, which I won't go into. So the question is there a better justification? So what motivates all this is that, well, if we have a universal log law and it's a solution to an equation, then that universal solution should be come from an invariant equation or an invariant form of the equation that's parameter free, doesn't vary, and so you solve it once and you get it's effectively a similarity solution. And that's what we're looking for here. So we're looking for an invariant form of the equation on the domain of interest, solve that once, you get a log law. This is an asymptotic situation, though. So this has the proviso as the Reynolds number goes to infinity. Okay, and unlike laminar flows, there's a complication. So here's the equations compared to what I've seen this week thus far, the equations I have are much simpler. So this is just the mean momentum equation for the Piper channel, where we have a viscous force, the turbulent inertia, and the pressure gradient, which I'll denote as epsilon squared. So that's just equal to 1 over the Reynolds number. And then the boundary layer, which is more complicated, and I'll get to at the end of this talk, where we have the viscous force and turbulent inertia, but then we also have this mean advection term, which is not constant at any given Reynolds number, but is a profile. Okay, so unlike laminar flows, where like the laminar flat plate boundary layer, you have a balance between advection and diffusion, and that balance is leading order everywhere across the layer. That's not the case here. We have an equation, but not all terms are leading order everywhere. And so, for example, in layer 2, in the Piper channel or boundary layer, you see that there's a leading order balance between the viscous force and turbulent inertia, and thus their ratio is -1. As you go through layer 3, all three terms become of leading order, and then in layer 4, you have an inertial layer, or it becomes inertially dominated, where the balance is in the channel or pipe between the turbulent inertia and the pressure gradient. Okay, what I want to focus on, because it's critical to describing the overall similarity solution that I'm going to describe, is the balance exchange through layer 3, okay? And so we go from layer 2, where we have a leading balance between the viscous force and turbulent inertia, and as we enter layer 3, this term becomes leading order. So this form really isn't appropriate because this epsilon squared implies it's small. Okay, so let's go ahead and take a look at the actual functions. So here they are. Yes.
So just on the previous slide, how do we, those layers, this is an empirical observation about.
This is right.
Okay,
this is a very, if you're going to close these equations, you either have to identify some hypothesis, make a claim, or you have to invoke some level of empiricism. There it is. Okay, so and I can show you empirical, but once we get to this, once I get the leading order balances, the rest is just analysis. Okay, so this is different from others. Once I've identified the leading balances in these equations, the rest is just analysis of the equations. Was that, did two people have the same question? I thought there was another. Okay, good question. All right, so here's the terms. And we have the turbulent inertia here, and so notice it goes through zero in the pipe or in the or channel, because that's the peak in the Reynolds stress, and then your viscous force goes here, and then your pressure gradient is constant all the way across. Okay, so here's where the layer two, the viscous force and turbulent inertia are dominant, and as we go through layer three, the viscous force loses leading order, and there's that exchange. But in this region, all three are of leading order, so we need to renormalize the equation to reflect that. And this can be done by just posing stretching coefficients, alpha and gamma, and then you demand that all terms are order one in the equation, and you can go ahead and solve for those coefficients, and they end up being epsilon, okay? And epsilon being 1 over the square root Reynolds number. This, by the way, is the reason why you have square root Reynolds number dependence in the peak of the Reynolds stress. And I could show you some superpipe data that shows this out to a Reynolds number of about 100,000 in delta plus. And it's compelling. Okay, so with those transformations, you get this invariant equation, and you have rescaled variables where now you want to think about the origin of this patch where the scaling holds as being at the peak in the Reynolds stress or somewhere in that layer, okay? The peak of the Reynolds stress is convenient. Okay, so the point here is that we can rescale it to get an invariant equation in that layer. All right, now it gets a little more complicated, but conceptually not. Okay, so now I'm going to say, let's pose this transformation, which we call T beta, okay? T is your Reynolds stress. And I'm just taking we're gonna call it the adjusted Reynolds stress. Where does this come from? Well, if we look at Couette flow and we throw away this term and just have this beta term, then this is the transformation that takes you between channel flow equation and the Couette flow equation. This is the transformation that does that. Okay, if I take this transformation, which we call the adjusted Reynolds stress, and this beta is going to help us determine the effect of inertia as a function of scale, we plug it into the mean momentum equation, then we get this, where we've now replaced the epsilon squared term with beta. But look, if I take the derivative of this, then we have T beta is equal to this sequence of terms. And at every T beta equals zero for a given value of beta, then that's going to go through a peak in the adjusted Reynolds stress, and it's going to have a structure just like layer three, okay? And so we pick some beta, which is equal to this function, and this is what it looks like, and it identifies a location away from the wall, so it identifies a location, and we can rescale the equations at that location, and there's a layer width like layer three at that location. In fact, you can do it at every location where this function is monotonically decreasing, okay? And if we do that, we can solve, just like we did before with the rescalings, and we get these rescalings, and if you plug it into the equation, you get an invariant equation on every one of this hierarchy of layers. Okay, these are finite width layers that are a continuous distribution of them. Okay, and we can actually, the theory tells us that the width of the layer is order beta to the minus 1/2, and you can actually use beta to the minus 1/2 without losing any generality. It turns out that this grouping here, which is nothing more than the intermediate or hat variable normalization of the second derivative of the Reynolds stress, is critical because it tells us about the flux of force across each one of these layers. The theory tells us that this function becomes invariant as the Reynolds number goes to infinity on this layer, and that's simply because the layer is becoming infinite, and the only thing that could break that similarity is edge effects. Okay? And so on each layer, the condition for dynamic self-similarity is given by this function at y hat equals zero. So this is like the peak in the T beta, like the position of the Reynolds stress peak, but for each one of these layer. And like I said before, physically it's the normalized flux of turbulent inertial force. Okay, so we're getting some different interpretations of what this von Karman constant is because of what's said at the bottom of this slide, and I'll show in a minute. Okay, you can also analytically show that the layer widths, their distribution, so the variation in layer width, is identically equal to A over 2, okay? And if you invert this, you can see we're just scaling the Y location with the width of the layer, and that width of the layer is interpreted as the scale of the turbulent motions responsible for wallward momentum transport. So these are the scale of the UV motions, okay? This, by the way, in fact, the linearity of dw/dy, which is predicted by the theory, is the origin of distance from the wall scaling. Okay, What I'll show here is that this phi sub c, or a squared over 4, actually becomes the leading coefficient in the log law, and I'll show that in the next couple slides. And so that gives a new interpretation of kappa. It's the function that describes the constant coordinate stretching underlying the asymptotic self-similarity that leads to a log law, or it's associated with the asymptotically constant flux of turbulent inertial force across this hierarchy of layers. Okay, so you can actually compute the layer hierarchy, or the width distribution, and here it is for a bunch of different Reynolds numbers. And the outer edge of layer 3 ends up being at about 2.6 square root Reynolds number. And you can see, as the theory predicts, that this function becomes linear. This is log-log, but that's, trust me, that's a slope of 1. Becomes linear, and the slope of that, as I showed with the blue data earlier on, the slope of that is related to the von Karman constant. Okay, and so as I said before, physically W is the size of the minus UV motions, and the linearity of that is the origin of distance from the wall scaling, at least according to this theory. Okay, last part, and then I'll go to the boundary layer. All right, so you can take that equation for the A equation and expand it not in terms of the hat variables, which is on each layer, but just in terms of plus variables. And we'll express it in terms of phi rather than in terms of A, you get this equation. Now, I go ahead and invoke the exact form of the mean vorticity equation, and I can get everything in terms of U. Now I have a nonlinear equation, and this is where Martin Overlock came in, and you can integrate this. And if you integrate it, you get a log law. Okay, so what have I done? I've taken the equations of motion, transformed them, used similarity for closure, and integrated them to get a log law. But interestingly, there's a linear part here. But we know that as y plus goes to infinity, or delta plus goes to infinity, b has to go to 0. And in fact, it has to go to 0 faster than 1 over delta plus. And so let's go ahead and look. So here's the classical way of looking at data. And so you're in a talk, and somebody presents their DNS data. And you see the log layer, and you say, yeah, that's the log region, but let's look at it closely. And so what I've done here is the black data are the profiles from the DNS, and the colored profiles are those, they're fits to this equation where we've just set y naught equal to 0. I'll show you the effect of y naught in a second. And we then fit phi squared b and c. Okay, just, and the point here is, okay, well, you know, I have some latitude here to make this thing fit, but these fits can be made to happen to within 1 in 10,000, right? The data don't vary from the actual DNS profile by more than 1 in 10,000. And so you can see they're right on top of them. The thing here is, under the classical, you don't have a monotonic Reynolds number trend. There's an actual scatter to these data, and in fact, the delta plus of 4,000 data is below the one in 5,000, where all the other ones are decreasing with increasing Reynolds number. So it's a little puzzling there. Let's look at it in terms of the similarity formulation. In the similarity formulation, the first thing you do is you write it in terms of, hold on, I'm having a glasses malfunction here. Let's get rid of this. You write it in terms of our stretched coordinate, which aligns the beginning of the inertial layer. Oh, notice in the previous one, the inertial layer, according to this theory, in some cases, if your Reynolds number variation is large enough, one starts after the other one ends. Okay, here it aligns them all. And then you align up the velocities at the beginning of the inertial layer, and you can see the low Reynolds number ones have that curvature effect associated with the linear part, and then at the higher Reynolds numbers, those things all straighten out and approach a logarithmic profile. Okay. Just last thing here, coefficients, the B coefficient drops. This is the effect of Y naught, these different lines, but you can see it drops at a value greater than 1 over Reynolds number, or faster than 1 over Reynolds number, and we get something that's approaching 0.382 for the von Karman constant. All right, now the bigger problem is the boundary layer. And so now we have viscous force, turbulent inertial force, but now we've got a function here. It's not just a constant. And the reason we were able to make this work for the channel is that this is just 1 over Reynolds number, right? But instead, we have this thing here, okay? So now we have to deal with that. To help deal with that, we're going to be looking at some high Reynolds number data. Some of the data was taken in the high Reynolds number boundary layer wind tunnel at the University of Melbourne, and it features a 27-meter working section, which allows you to get a big, thick boundary layer and get good spatial resolution. The other is the flow physics facility at New Hampshire, which just has a 72-meter test section, which allows you to get that high Reynolds number and good spatial resolution as well. We're not going to use all the data from this, but we used a mini-style FOSS probe, which is a 4-wire probe in which we actually weave some of the wires between each other to make it compact. And then Caleb Morrow-Winter, this is marvelous data sets, really high quality. Hopefully I can convince you of that as I show some of the data here. He figured out an advanced or more advanced processing scheme, especially for the X-ray, where he used data from the parallel array as well. Okay, so this probe gives you UV and the spanwise vorticity fluctuations. I won't be showing those today. Okay, and then just the range of Reynolds numbers goes from about delta plus of 2400, and we have a DNS that compares favorably with that, up to about 16,400. And notice that the spatial resolution here, so this is internormalized scale of the probe, is very good over the whole Reynolds number range. Okay, so behavior of the mean inertia. Here's the mean inertia term, so this is a good indication of the quality of these data. These are experimental data. We have to differentiate them multiple times, and we get profiles that look pretty good. And so here it is, just A plus versus Y plus or Y over delta. The Y over delta plot, you see that the peak occurs at about the same location in all of these profiles, whereas the Reynolds number dependence is that they are decreasing with increasing Reynolds number. If we take these profiles and normalize them by their peak, you get something that's very close to being an invariant curve. And what's even more fortuitous or, makes me happy, is that the peak decays almost perfectly with 1 over Reynolds number. Okay, so we have a almost perfect 1 over Reynolds number dependence in the peak value with increasing Reynolds number. Okay, well, we can use some of these properties to advantage. In fact, if you take this this A bar, which we just, it's a normalized, or alpha bar, which is a normalized value of alpha, defined here as the ratio of A to its peak value, and we integrate that, then we get a constant for all Reynolds numbers. That's another attractive feature. And then we can normalize alpha of X and Y by alpha bar, and we get another quantity, which will show up here in a minute. Okay? If we take alpha bar and multiply it by A peak, you can show analytically that that's actually equal to 1 over the Reynolds number. That's an analytical result. Empirically, we found it empirically first, and then we figured out that it was an analytical result. We found it to be 1.003, so that's another indication of the quality of the data. What have we done? We've taken this term here, and we broke it in. So we got the desirable 1 over Reynolds number dependence. Now we just need to show that this thing is constant, okay? And then we have a form that looks just like the channel flow, and we can show that. Well, once you have that, the channel flow analysis shows us exactly that we get the same von Karman constant, same self-similarity as in the boundary layer. Okay? Now remember that the leading balance in the outer layer is between the turbulent inertia and mean inertia, and thus we can take advantage of the fact that these two profiles are basically mirror symmetric. So what do? We do a transformation that takes a chunk of the mean advection and dumps it into the turbulent inertia part, and that's what this is right here, and you get an equation that looks just like this if you use that, and you've integrated out the y plus dependence there, but, and thus, alpha m could still be a function of delta plus, but it turns out it's not, or at least to the data we have, that it's a constant is equal to 0.46. The point here is that once we have this equal to a constant, then we recover a form of the mu momentum equation that's just like the channel flow, and we can do the analysis that I showed for the channel flow and recover the exact same von Karman constant. Okay, well, just a couple slides. First of all, what's that transformation look like? So here's the transformation. These are expanded plots at different magnification levels. So this is just a plot of the three terms in the mean momentum balance. This is for DNS here, just for illustrative purposes. So we have the turbulent inertia, the mean inertia is down here, and then the viscous force. So this is like layer two. As we head into layer three, the actual profiles look like this and this for the turbulent inertia and mean inertia. So that's why I say they're not constant. But if we go ahead and do the transformation, then we turn it into this and this on the inertial domain. And thus we end up with constants that we can go ahead and integrate. Makes the analysis much more simple. Okay, so I'm not going to go through the analysis again that I did for the channel because we've already seen that. What I want to do is convince you that we get the right scaling behaviors or that the data bear out the right scaling information. Okay, so the first thing is that we go ahead and write things in terms of our transform coordinates about layer three. We should be able to take all the data at all the Reynolds number and write them on invariant curves that define the zero crossing of the TI and the this intermediate normalization, and I put that as evidence that that's the case. The theory should yield a square root Reynolds number dependence in the peak in the Reynolds stress, and there's the data, and that this is a Reynolds number a quarter or three quarters, and this is a quarter, and that's a half. The last thing is that the layer width across layer three, which is one of the ones on the hierarchy, should attain a constant at sufficiently high Reynolds numbers. You can see this plateauing here provides evidence of that. The last one, and probably the most compelling, is that at each Reynolds number, we have a hierarchy of scaling layers. That means we should be able to use the transformations at any position in this hierarchy and transform the data onto the invariant curves. So here's the DNS data at 2400, and we've taken a bunch of positions and retransformed the, now chi is, think of it as beta, as in the previous case. We called it chi in this paper because it's slightly different because we have different transformation for the Reynolds stress. But this is like the T beta. So this is like the layer to layer transition. We should be able to write that in an invariant form. And so we have probably 15 different layers piled on top of these. And we get these invariant curves, which the theory predicts. Similarly, and this is probably the best indication of the quality of the data, we can do this with the data at multiple positions on the hierarchy at a fixed Reynolds number. Now, all of these should fall on top of each other, and I'll just let you visually convince yourself of that. This to me, is really an indication of remarkable data, because think about what we had to do. We had to measure the Reynolds stress, take its derivative, transform it, measure the mean velocity, differentiate it twice, and transform it. Okay, try to do that with your experimental data. Okay, all right, so what do we got? We got for channel flow, one can begin with the mean equation, transform it to an invariant form, and analytically integrate it to get an asymptotically universal log loss similarity solution. We can do the same thing with boundary layer, but we have this additional step, and I say it's a scenario because that additional step required an observation that this alpha underscore bar is a constant. It recovers asymptotic slope and gives a justification for why the boundary layer von Karman constant is the same as that in the channel and pipe. And I'll just note that the overall model analysis is consistent with attached eddy notions, the self-similar hierarchy of the McKeon-Sharma model, which they're going to talk about later, and the physical structure of the uniform momentum zone and vortical fissures revealed by the Meinhardt and Adrian study. In other words, each one of these layers has a fixed velocity jump and a scale associated with it, and that corresponds nicely with this uniform momentum zone vortical fissure structure. And I'll stop there. Thanks.
Okay, questions?
Bruno Eckhardt, Marburg. I wanted to ask about these
W's that you introduce, sort of this stack of structures. And you indicated that you had sort of this hierarchy had some scaling to go with it. Can you go back to those slides?
Yes.
Maybe you had this master curve on which all these curves, these structures were sitting. And I was wondering to which extent there is sort of a...
This one?
No, before. Before. That one.
This one.
So this master curve in which you all plotted them, where does that come from? Can you say something about
this? This is the turbulent inertia term plus the pressure gradient.
Yeah.
And that's that function. On the portion of it that's monotonically decaying, you can define a position. So that's a beta value. We'll call it beta 1 for there. Okay? At that position, dt beta dy goes through 0. That means it's a peak in that function. Thus, there's a peak in the Reynolds stress, just like across layer 3. We can rescale this equation into an invariant form, like across layer 3, and then we can just repeat that process. In fact, we can repeat it for every y location along this decaying curve.
Okay, and so where did you get the betas from, the locations?
Where did I get them? So give me a beta value, and I'll find it on this curve. Okay, so beta is equal to turbulent inertia, this guy, plus that. So what does this transformation do? This transformation, so in Couette flow, that's the curve, okay, because there is no pressure gradient.
Yeah.
And so and this looks just like the Couette flow curve, you know, that it approaches zero, because we're taking the offset for the pressure gradient and just pushing it up. Okay, well, so this curve is universal at any given, well, it's universal because if you change the Reynolds number, then you change this epsilon squared term.
Okay, we'll get back to this later in private, but you indicated with the indices on the beta that they seem to be a discrete set.
Oh, I just did that because, well, I don't know what I could call this.
Is it a discrete set or is it a continuum?
No, you can think of it, because these layers are finite in width, so think of it as a region over which the particular local scaling is operative.
All right.
Okay? It's finite width, but it's a continuous hierarchy. So I can define a beta at any given position on this curve, but the curves, the regions overlap. Okay? So you can use a discrete version of it. Yes.
So I'm Björn Birnir from here. The fluctuations and the moments also are observed to satisfy a log law. Does your theory explain that as well?
We're working on that, okay? What I can say is we did a study of different measures of self-similarity. So we did the Kullback-Leibler divergence and looked at the PDFs of the U fluctuations. And then we looked where those that function is constant. And then we also looked where the slope of the fluctuations is, the U fluctuations, is logarithmic. And we compared it with the domain predicted by the theory, probably best shown on here, where this is linear, okay? And this this corresponds almost exactly. Well, no, it's bigger than either the Kullback-Leibler or fluctuation. So those parts are internal to this layer. So they overlap, but this one's a little wider. And then if we looked at where the diagnostic plot, are you familiar with that, the Alfredson thing? Then the region where this linearity holds is almost identical to where their diagnostic plot holds, which is another measure of self-similarity, okay? So we know that all these things line up as why you get a logarithmic U variance, we haven't got to yet with this theory, okay? We'd like to.
Other questions?
Yun Huang, Imperial College. When you show that you have invariant form of the self-similar equation throughout the little layer, how do you actually treat the boundary condition for
this is an internal the self-similar region is internal to the flow.
So
if I have to, you know, so when we originally did comparison with...
because the original equation had a boundary.
Yeah, so when we originally tried to solve this equation here, I did it numerically, and I just picked the values off of the of a DNS and then compared with the DNS.
Yes.
I could pick the initial conditions and then just integrate this equation. I got agreement within one part or so in 10,000. And then Martin helped me out and showed me we could just go ahead and integrate the thing. And so we don't treat the boundary conditions. We just get a functional form here.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Mike Graham, Wisconsin. I was just wondering if you could elaborate on your last comment about the connection with the uniform momentum zones, and I guess I'm not seeing that that connection.
Is it okay if I draw on the board?
You can erase the horseshoe there. I drew it, so you have my permission.
So in the theory, it says there's a series of layers. And it specifies, across each layer, it specifies a velocity jump. And this layer becomes linearly, the width of this overall layer becomes linearly proportional to distance from the wall. Okay, but we know it has to be an inertial domain. So that the velocity jump, the region where there's shear, has to be small volumetrically. And so what does that mean? That means you have a thin region where there's a jump, and then you have the rest of the layer. Okay, if I stack this to the next one, right? Uniform momentum zone, velocity jump.
I'm not seeing where that emerges from the analysis.
No, I'm just saying that the structure predicted, where that emerges from the analysis is here, where we have a linear distribution in velocity. So this is the thing I showed there, where they're getting bigger with distance from the wall. What I wasn't able to show today is that with each one of these layers, there's a velocity increment. It's basically the velocity increment across layer three. Okay, that becomes invariant with Reynolds number, under internormalization. So there's a order U tau jump, a big inertial region, nominally uniform momentum, then an order U tau jump. So you get a stair step type of profile.
Other questions?
And Jimenez from Madrid. I mean, in this experiment, those layers are not anywhere. I mean, they move up and down. They're actually 3D. They're three-dimensional.
This is a mean equation.
But those are not. I mean, those sharp layers that Ron Edgen finds, they're moving up and down.
Oh yeah, of course.
They're of course. Implied.
Yeah, I mean, if they weren't moving, then none of these profiles would be smooth, right? So they mix, right? So
that's what I don't see. What this has to do with your analysis?
Well, there's a scrambling associated with that.
There is not only a scrambling; they are not layers. I mean, they're like tunnels.
They have three dimensionality. I'm just saying, on average, there's a level of consistency between that structure and what we see here.
I mean, you have something inclined like this. On average, is nowhere. You cannot give it a height.
But if you look at the actual jumps in the outer region, they're not all inclined.
They're not inclined.
The vertical fissures in the outer region they become quite parallel to the wall.
That's because you are seeing a very short stretch of the layer. They are inclined. According to Ron, I mean, I'm not speaking about DNA.
Okay, so I guess I would. I don't know how else to answer this, but maybe modify. And the physical structure seems to me to be consistent with the uniform momentum zones and vertical fissures revealed by Meinhardt and Adrian.
Any more questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Joe. Concludes our talks for today, but we have lunch, I believe.